No Direction and Paizo team up to bring you the Gen Con 2018 seminar coverage. No Direction would like to thank our advertising sponsor, the Roll for Combat Starfinder Actual Play Podcast. Listen at rollforcombat.com.
All right. Well, we're just a few minutes after 11 here, and the door just closed, so I think we'll get started. Hi, everybody. I am Jason Bowman. I'm the director of game design at Paizo. I am joined by the rest of the design team here today. I'm going to let them introduce themselves here in just a second. But today we're going to be talking about this little old thing. I hope a lot of you have already picked this up. We'll be talking about the Pathfinder playtest rulebook here in this. We have a seminar directly after this that's a lot of Q&A. So this one's going to be mostly us talking. The next one will be mostly you guys talking. So we might have a little bit of time for questions at the end of this. But before we get started, I'll let the rest of my panel introduce themselves.
Hi, everybody. I'm Stephen Radney McFarlane. I'm the senior designer on the design team.
I'm Logan Bonner. I am a designer on the design team.
And I'm Mark Seifter. I'm a designer on the design team.
So we've been working on this for about 3 years now, 2.5, 3 years, mostly in secret, hiding in our caves, scribbling on walls, looking at the game that we've been building and making for, 10 years, really. Well, 10 years now. Trying to figure out, what about the game made it Pathfinder? What parts of it we really loved? What parts of it we knew we had to strengthen? What parts were a little bit of a problem? What things didn't work so well at the table? We've been listening to all of you for 10 years. Play the game. Talk about the game. Tell us about the game. And we noticed some patterns. There were some things that weren't quite working as intended. There are some things that we could have done better. There are other things in the game that over 10 years we designed and added on to the game, but they were never a native part of the game. Archetypes didn't come along until after the game was made. And as a result, they were always a little bolt-on. That's why you didn't see too many for, clerics, because they didn't have anything to trade out. So we didn't do a lot of archetypes for clerics. That was kind of a failing. Everybody else got to have fun, unless you were a cleric, then, go sit down over there. You don't get anything. So there was a lot of things that we looked at the game and saw some opportunities to make Pathfinder the best game we could possibly make. How many of you have been playing Pathfinder since the first beta 10 years ago? All right. How many of you have been at least playing for a few years? Oh, just about everybody. Okay, great. So there's an awful lot to talk about here. How do we want to break this down? Do we just want to talk about the individual components? Do we talk about design philosophy? What do you guys want to do?
Both of those sound cool.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. I think they sound cool. Let's just not go chapter by chapter.
Page one. What is a role-playing game?
How about we talk about a big change and then we'll explain why?
Sure.
That sounds
pretty good.
I want to take just a moment to talk about one of my big driving goals for this game, and that was to kind of take the entry to the game and make it a bit easier for everybody to understand. Pathfinder First Edition required you to learn quite a bit about the game engine itself. You had to learn how all the scaling systems work. You had to figure out about how all the classes work and all the skills work. There was a lot of things you needed to learn on an individual basis before you could even really get playing. I wanted to smooth that barrier to entry, that hurdle you had to jump to go from being someone who just bought the book to being someone playing the game. And to do that, we needed to look at the system holistically and kind of say, okay, well, what's tripping us up the most? Well, all of the classes work differently, so we can't explain that to you in one simple way because they're all kind of different. That's not to say that all the classes in the new game are identical, far from it, but the way that every class in First Edition was put together was kind of radically different from the class next to it. A paladin didn't look anything like a wizard. And they shouldn't, right? They need to have different things and do different things. But there are some similarities that we could latch on to, some places where we could take the system and make it a more streamlined approach, just to allow you to have an easier inroad. But I think the counter side to that is that we wanted to make sure that once you got down that first road, that it then branched off in a million different directions so that you could build the kind of character you wanted to build, right? We didn't want to hand you a game that's just like, well, it's easy to learn, but you can only make one character out of it. That's not what we wanted. What we wanted was a game that you could get over those initial hurdles quickly and then learn the depth of the character that you wanted to play. The space that you spend all the time learning is in what you want your character to be, not just the generic rules of the overall game system.
Part of that as well is when we talk about classes look the same, we're really talking about underlying architecture, right? And so the whole thing about it is when you learn rogue, you learn about rogue talents and everything else in first edition, and then over here you've got rage powers or something else like that. All of those things actually sit in the same kind of design space. They're just ways that you can make individual choices within your character. But when you start giving them to a new player and you have to explain them, there's this sort of a bit of a disconnect. Oh, these things are different. It's all like yes and no. We wanted to sort of strengthen on the similarities, right? So when you went from one class to another because you're multi-classing or you take an archetype or something like that, you know how the system works, even though you're making interesting choices for your character that are different than the person sitting next to you. Playing with kids has helped me a lot, right? The less I have to sort of go, well, that's just the way it is. That's just the way we call it. And I could just go, well, yeah, this is how it works. And they go, oh, all right. And they nod their head. And then the next thing we know, we're rolling dice and fighting monsters and everything else. That's a win to me.
Yeah, and that applies to a lot of things where if it serves a similar function, it is now kind of called the same thing. Like things that you select that give you some additional character benefits are feats. If something is a magic thing that you activate by spending some actions to do it, that is a spell, and the spells kind of work like spells. They might have very different effects.
Right.
And if it's something that is contributing to your checks, that is following the same system of bonuses, even if the fighters got a much higher one on their attack rolls and the rogue has a much higher one on their stealth skill, they use the same architecture, so you can really understand them easily rather than having a bunch of kind of ones that operate on different rules.
Right. Yeah. And one of the advantages of that, to go back to Steven's example of the rogue talents and the rage powers, as you guys probably know from Pathfinder First Edition, they're pretty similar. You get them every second level. They have a different name. But there are some subtle differences that you're going to have to remember that always might trip you up until you've played a lot of times. The rage powers have prerequisites that can be any even level beyond second, but the rogue talents don't. They are split into either ones that you can get at any time or ones that you can get only at 10th level and above. And so removing things like that, and like let's say we had in Pathfinder First Edition been like, well, these are rogue class feats and barbarian class feats. They can come at any level from second and above for both of them. They have the same name. That's easier to...
Well, and the funny part is we were slowly running out of additional adjectives to put at the end of the name there, right? I mean, barbarian powers, rogue talents, discoveries. We ended up having to come up with all these different names for what was, in essence, the same thing. And that didn't help us any. It didn't help us categorize them better. It didn't help us... The only thing it did was just give them a different name so that you knew you were picking from that. And we were like, well, why are we even doing that? If we just put the class name in front of it, you know what it is, right? If I say it's a barbarian feat, you're not going to be like, oh, well, I'm in the rogue. I guess I can take one of these. You're not going to get confused by that. So the word that came on the end was kind of like, well, I don't know why we're calling that a different thing. If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, let's just call it a duck. Or in this case, a feat.
Right.
We actually had a lot of discussions with that internally. That's kind of a funny little thing. For a while there were some folks inside Paizo that were like, take all the feats and put them in one chapter. And I'm like, no! No, I don't want to do that, because then you have to flip all the way through a giant chapter just to look and compare your four barbarian feats that you have to choose from right now. I'd much rather have all those together so that you can compare like to like. You get to pick one of those four anyway, so you might as well look at them together and decide which one is best. It does more than just simplify your ability to access the game and access your class. It also then allows you to look at those things and see how they, as together, how they speak to the concept they're attached to, right? So when you see all the dwarf ancestral feats, you're looking at them and those speak to what dwarves are. You get a sense of what a dwarf is just by looking at all the feats that it can choose from. If I put those in a giant chapter filled with all the elf feats and all the other things, you lose that. That sense of what it is becomes lost in the kind of mix of everything. Talking about one other thing that we standardized, and this is one of the bigger changes to the game. One of the big things that we did is we looked at all the various math formulas. This is going to get kind of wonky. But the game had a lot of different math formulas to do different things. Base attack bonus. You had full, which was basically 1-to-1. You had two-thirds.
Three quarters,
which went 0, 1, 2, 3, 3, 4, 5, 6, 6, 7, 8, 9, 9. I have that memorized. I can do that in my sleep.
Yep.
But for a new player, that's really irritating. It's like, why does it do that? Saving throws did the same thing. You know, you started out, 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 5, 5, 6, 6. And then 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 2, 2, 2. Yep. Right? You had the two different progressions.
Two plus a half versus one third.
Which all of them did... All of them were there to serve a purpose, to say this guy's better at this thing than this other guy. That's fine. You know, we want the game to say you're better at this thing than this guy. Wizards are better at will saves than fighters. We want the game to have that understanding. But using different math formulas for every piece of this just adds a level of complexity to the game that I don't think anybody actually really appreciates. And worse still, at high levels, this is what caused high-level play to fracture. Once you got up into high-level play, you would find that, you know, you as a wizard got worse and worse at fortitude saving throws the higher up you went. You didn't get better. You actually got actively worse as you went up.
Relative to what you were dealing with.
Well, exactly, right? Yeah. Because at first level, you were only down by two, right? You had a zero versus the fighter who had a plus two, you know, ability scores aside. But at high levels, you had a plus... You know, four, and he's got a nine or something, right? It was a big gulf of difference. You got actively further away from the top benchmark, and that all of that put together made us look at the entire math engine of the system and go, you know, we need a system that once we explain it to you, you'll understand what it means, no matter what it is you're looking at, and that's where the proficiency system was born. I realize a lot of you are very new with the book, so you probably haven't necessarily dug into this. You're at Gen Con, so I don't expect you to be sitting in the hallway reading.
Talk about math. Come on.
Yeah, that's right.
It's early in the morning.
It's a Friday morning math seminar.
That's right.
All right.
We're really trying to make it less math finder. That's what we're trying to tell you.
Well, that's actually the whole point, right? So the proficiency system says, yeah, you're adding your level to most numbers, and then the proficiency just adds a bonus or a penalty on top of that. So if you're untrained at a thing, it's your level minus two. If you're trained, it's your level. If you're an expert, it's your level plus one. Master, level plus two. Legend, level plus three. And once you understand that formula, those differences, and I just explained them to you, so you guys are masters now. You guys got this.
No, which means
you
get legendary.
A plus two.
They're legendary.
That applies to everything. If I tell you you're a master at attacking with longswords, you know that your bonus on that is equal to your level plus two. Of course, because it's a longsword attack, it's also going to have your strength and a few other things in there, but you know the base formula. The base formula is the same. If I say that rogue is a legend at stealth, you know that rogue is adding his level plus three. There's a lot more depth to it than that.
Right.
And it does three main things for us. One is that it makes it so you can really easily look at and compare things across the classes. So if I'm trying to decide between being a rogue or being a fighter or being an alchemist, I can kind of look at those and I can say, okay, the fighter is going to become a master with weapons really early. The rogue is not going to become a master, so I know they're not as good at attacking. Rather than kind of comparing a set of numbers and then trying to kind of figure out, kind of reverse engineer it, you can kind of look at these things in comparison, especially with saving throws. It's really easy to compare class to class. The second thing it does is it gives us ways to kind of gatelock things, to kind of say somebody has to be an expert to do this, a master to do this, rather than saying, like, I have to have a base attack bonus of plus four, which there are kind of a lot of different ways to get to that through multi-classing and stuff. We can say you have to be an expert at melee attacks or whatever it is.
That really comes into play in skills a lot. Skills are really gatelocked behind various things, and a lot of that comes with skill feats as well. That's how you can't take this skill feat until later. Skill feats are a way for you to differentiate your character and his skills from everybody else around you. So you can say, oh, well, I'm going to be the one who's really good at Arcana, so I'm going to take the skill feats that make my Arcana checks better than everyone else's. But you can only do those once you have reached certain proficiency levels, right? The proficiencies become an easy way for us to say, well, you're really good at this. You know, you're the best at this. And that allows us to kind of say, well, you can't do that until you hit this point, right? I mean, the big example that we've used in the past is just like when you're trying to make high quality weapons, you need to have a craft rank equal to the rank of the weapon you're trying to make. You can't make expert quality weapons unless you're an expert quality crafter or expert proficient crafter.
Yeah. Right.
And so if you are, you know that an expert in crafting means you're using your level plus one. And also, if you craft an expert quality weapon, its item bonus is going to be plus one. So right. You can kind of compare.
There's
like
a lot of
like
parallelism in there.
Yeah, we stop doing everything different ways just for the sake of doing it differently.
And there's some big advantages to having things being done in similar ways. One of them is that when your defenses, like Jason said, with the wizard are going up at a different rate than the enemy's offenses, it can make you have a serious problem, and we've gotten rid of that. But another one is in design space. A lot of people, let me tell you, I've gotten a lot of things in from freelancers where they would like to use a skill check against somebody's AC or somebody's saving throws or something like that, but they fundamentally go up at drastically different rates. It's even worse than doing 42
saves. Or rather
they
did.
Or they did in Pathfinder First Edition.
My bluff is plus 40.
My bluff is plus 40, and I can get it to 60 with glibness, and this guy's will save that I'm trying to go against is like plus 8. But if they're parallel, you can do the thing that instinctively a lot of homebrew GMs and a lot of designers want to do, which is test various skills and other abilities against various defenses for a
reasonable,
unique and interesting power.
Yeah, which allowed us to do things like if you want to grapple somebody, that's an athletics check against their
Fortitude
DC.
Yeah.
Which made the game, we were like, oh, solved. Done. That makes perfect sense. It speaks to the character's resiliency and their ability to shrug off somebody trying to get a hold of them. And athletics is the skill that really is kind of all about being, you know, muscular and grabbing people. All right, this is going in the wrong direction.
So, anyway, there's another really awesome and great advantage of having kind of this sort of unified theory of numbers. And that is, on the player side, when you go up every level, you know how long it takes you to figure out what all of your new stats are. It's very simple now, right? I mean, basically, things usually just go up by plus one, unless there's some sort of reason not to.
And you're usually focusing on one thing at a time.
And
so
yeah.
I'm going up in level, I get a skill increase. I really want to be better at crafting,
right.
And I'm going to put that skill increase into crafting. And then that is the thing that I'm kind of concentrating on that level.
Yeah. And so the real hard choices are in like the very particular things you want to do rather than just the numbers. Your numbers are very easy to figure out what you want to go, and it's all like, oh, what kind of feats do I want? What kind of new spells do I want? That's where all of the brain power goes into. And so even if you want to, you know, level up in between a game, it's going to be, you know, in the middle of a session, it's going to be a lot easier. On the flip side, on the GM side, like if you're finding that your players are just wiping up these monsters and you want to level them up really quickly, that's also easier to do, right? It'll give you a better grasp of what the background math is, give you a lot more leniency to go, okay, I'm going to bump up this encounter like this because my players are having too easy of a time or too hard of a time in the other direction, right? To make that narrative move a little bit more smoothly without wondering, if I dig too deep into the wires, what am I screwing up? One of the things we want to give everybody with this edition is a better understanding of what those wires are, and make them less likely to cross and go haywire.
So one of the things about having kind of this more unified numerical system is that it takes a little of the emphasis on character building out of getting the highest numbers possible, and more into tactics and what your tactics are going to be. And that talks directly to the new action system, because we kind of changed up the actions so that you have three actions on your turn and you can use them for whatever you want. That means that a spellcaster, though, is going to use those actions in a very different way from a martial character. So when you're building your character, you're looking a lot about kind of, if you're trying to kind of maximize your character's efficiency, you're going to look at, like, how am I going to be spending my actions? What are the best options for me? So when you're picking your spells, it's going to be like, okay, this one's, most spells are going to be two actions, but there are going to be a few. It's like, I might want to have a one action spell, like shield is one action to give yourself a defense boost. So you're going to be looking at options so that you can kind of maximize that action economy. Do we want to talk about that?
Yeah, well, I mean,
a little more detail.
This is another thing that when we looked at the game, we were like, boy, that's a barrier to entry. It's like, hey, new player, you've decided to play our game. Okay, what's your turn? We're in the middle of a fight. You can take a move action or a standard action. Or you can forego those and take a full round action. You can also take a 5-foot step, but not if you use your move action to move. You get a free action. You can have as many of those as you want, and you can put those anywhere you want. You get a swift action, but not if you took an immediate action between the past turn and this turn. There's also an attack of opportunity, but you only get to take that when somebody threatens you. And all of a sudden, they're just like, what am I even playing? I don't know what this is.
There's also not an action.
Oh, and then there's not an action. There are like 8 different ways that you could... And now I'm just like, hey, it's your turn, new player. You get to do 3 things. What do you want to do? Let's go. And just that change of saying you can do 3 things. Most things you can think of are one of those 3 things. You want to open a door? That's an action. You want to draw a weapon? Yeah. That's an action.
Or at least one of those things. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to move up to your speed? That's an action. You want to make an attack? That's an action. We no longer limit you or require you to take those things in an order, right? You want to take an attack, then move, then take another attack? Do that. Do the thing that tactically works for you in the fight. It allows... It's a huge benefit to martial characters because they don't... If they start a full attack action after they've moved, and kill the guy in the first hit, they're done. Their turn is done. They just spent the whole thing doing something that didn't feel very heroic. But now at least they can continue moving and set up for the next fight.
The action economy also opens itself up for a little bit of GM fiat as well, more so than the old one. Like the interact action, which is a very basic action, and it's I shut a door, I grab a thing, I do something with a part of my body in which something happens. We're getting there, kids.
Not this panel.
But we've all, if you've been a GM and somebody comes up with this great idea that reasonably should work in that situation that you designed but you didn't anticipate, and you're like, what kind of action is that? Is it a standard? Is that like, it's all, oh yeah, interact. Yeah, go ahead, give that a shot. And then you can even add a skill check onto it as well if there's a chance for failure. And it allows you to move on the game rather than flipping through your book and going, I have no idea how to adjudicate this right now, either because I didn't find it in, chapter 6, subparagraph 15 or whatever. So it also gives you flexibility to go on the fly and get the game going rather than having it grind to a halt. Trust me, players will always find ways to grind your game to a halt. We can't fix that totally, but we're doing our best.
The next edition of the game, players won't be allowed to roll dice.
Right.
All right. we're just done with that. No. One of the other great things that the system opened up and allowed us to do is we said, hey, you get three actions. You can do 3 things on your turn. And then in addition to that, everybody can do 1 thing when it's not their turn. Everybody can have 1 reaction. You can technically take a reaction when it's on your turn, but most of the time you're going to take it when it's not your turn. And reactions are things that you have to have permission to take. You don't just take them whenever you want. They have to be triggered. The classic example of this is attack of opportunity, but now not everybody has that. It never kind of made sense for the wizard to be like, ha-ha, you dropped your defenses, and now I'm going to hit you with this dagger. And they're like, you had a dagger in
mostly
your hand? You never used that.
Mostly at higher level where your base attack bonus is so small that you're not going to hit it.
Yeah, no.
It meant the wizard had a rule to keep track of that was something that he didn't care about and that he was bad at.
Yeah,
and then he gets pressured to do in weird situations. Right. It's all like, why don't you take your attack?
Well, and the thing is,
this is why I missed.
why didn't you take it? Because it's pathetic.
But if a wizard has a counter spell instead, that's a lot more of a wizardly thing to do with his reaction.
And that's the thing: changing it to a reaction and then allowing us to open it up to classes in different ways allowed us to say, no, the thing you do is different. It's emblematic of you. Right. The more we looked at it, the more those exceptions lived in the game. We were like, okay, so attack of opportunity once. Counterspell was something you could ready an action to do. And we're like, oh, that wants to be a reaction. we just started realizing, wow, a lot of the classes have cool things that they want to do with that reaction, and we should let them do it if that's the choice you want to make. And if you don't take your reaction because you don't have a thing that gives you a reaction to spend, that's okay. That means when it's not your turn, you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to say, oh, did someone provoke from me so I can take an attack that isn't going to hit? No, you can finally go get that sandwich. But, you know, for a lot of characters, they do have cool reactions to play with, right? They've got counter spells. Rogues have a dodge mechanic where they can spend their reaction to crank up their AC by a little bit.
Oh, it's a nimble dodge.
It is a nimble dodge.
Yes.
Anybody who's wielding a shield gets a reaction that they can throw the shield in the way of the attack and have it take some of the damage.
The shield spell also has.
Yeah.
And it works on magic missile.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, that's true.
Your regular shield doesn't, though. Good luck on that. I blocked the magic missile. Yeah, take the damage. you're cute. You know, and that was kind of the fun things that we had with this game, actually. You know, a lot of the fun in designing it was coming up with these new systems and then looking at the things that we were like, oh, no, yeah, shield, regular shields can't block magic missile, but the spell shield certainly can. And realizing that that's how those pieces want to interact. And it still gives us the same flavor, the same story, the same narrative that we've always had. The shield spell blocks magic missiles. Everybody knows that. That's a
part
thing.
Of the zeitgeist.
Yeah, that's part of everyone's common understanding of those spells. And we wanted to keep that. And that gets to a deeper point, too, which is we wanted the story to be the same, right? You know, the number behind your attack bonus, between editions, your character wakes up and doesn't notice that there's a difference there. But if all of a sudden the shield spell doesn't block magic missiles, they're like, huh, that's funny, that worked yesterday. We didn't want that to change. We wanted you to be able to pick up a first edition adventure path, swap out the monster stat blocks, and still be able to run the entire adventure. The story isn't wrong now. There aren't elements of it that you're like, well, that doesn't work anymore, right? I mean, the spells still interact in some of the same ways you expect them to. I mean, there's going to be some small changes here and there, but on the whole, you know, the narrative of the game, the structure of the game is pretty much unchanged. Do we want to talk about modes of play?
Yeah, I mean, sure. That's another aspect of kind of the story.
Well, before we talk about that, I almost sometimes feel like I need to apologize. As, you know, we end up talking a lot about sort of the structure and everything else, and that's... And a lot of times we're just trying to build tools so you guys can have better play experiences, so we think about it in structure. Like, so even when we talk about modes of play, and everybody's, oh, well, what the heck are modes of play? Everybody knows what modes of play are. We've just sort of, sort of described it differently. And we're not the only ones who have done it. Like, everybody, we go, oh, it's encounter mode. Everybody knows that. You've rolled initiative for some reason. You know, every second counts. Every action needs to be tracked in a certain way. So we all know what that is. If we talk about exploration mode, it's all like, oh, yeah, that's when you're going to the forest or running through the city or whatever.
That's one of the things we see a lot when people play the new edition, because there's a lot of terminology that seems different. But once people play, it's like, oh, yeah, it has the same feel to it. Right. And the combats have the same sense of tension to them. What we tried to do was take some of the parts where the rules were kind of getting in the way, especially in kind of emergent play, and kind of smooth some of those out so that everything felt a little more natural and free-flowing when you were playing.
And in this case, it's more of we're giving a name to each of these three components of the game and talking about how they interact and flow into each other, sort of the Rumpelstiltskin principle that if you give a name to something, it gives you power over it, and it lets you understand and interact with it more. Particularly, this is for exploration mode, since combat encounters always had a name of encounters, and downtime had a name once it existed in Ultimate Campaign. But that thing that was in between didn't really have a name for it.
Also
and it
known
was a
as
little more,
most of the game.
Yes.
Most of the game.
That thing that was in, that thing that was in between 90% of the
we
game.
We almost
didn't really
went
have
with
a name.
Most of the game mode, but we decided to come up with
the rest of the game mode.
And you can also pretty easily play an entire campaign and never utter the word exploration mode, and it'll play the same way. It's mostly a tool for the GM. And we talk about how to transition between these modes, what the stakes of these modes are, how tightly you're going to be tracking time, how often you're going to be rolling. Those are the kind of things that are really different between these modes. So, for example, in downtime, you're doing like one roll to represent an entire day. And we also talk a lot about how you can flow into and out of each of these modes and in between them, especially exploration mode. Like if you're in downtime and somebody wants to go talk to people at the tavern, you're going to flow into another mode of playing, right? There's no hard barrier between them. No. And it's kind of a way of saying, all right, as a GM, you want to know how to transition between these and how each one is best used.
Spoiler alert, this is not the way to do it. Now we are entering exploration mode.
No. Stephen tries doing that every time in the office. It's the change of state is just once it's a thing you understand that you're changing between, you suddenly become aware of what pieces of information you need to know, right? So when you're exploring the dungeon and you as GM know that you're about to enter combat, one of the things you're going to do is kind of try and figure out, and we always did this before, well, what are you doing right now? Yeah. And you know that the monster is about to jump out from the drop out of the ceiling and attack them, but you're kind of trying to get a sense of what everyone's doing when that monster attacks so that you set up the combat right. You know, oh, you're over there digging through the chest, you're over here reading your book, you're taking a nap, and you're eating some food. Great, the monster's about to attack, now I know what's going on. Well, now we codify that a bit more directly, and we say, okay, well, what thing are you doing? And we can equate that to kind of various kind of exploration
tactics.
Yeah. Yep. Thanks, Mike. I was totally brain farting that one. What tactic you're kind of doing? What, you know? Oh, you're searching. Okay. Well, I know that means you're doing this. You know, if you're out in the wilderness, you might be using, you know, survival to follow tracks or things like that, right? And that puts you in a state right at the start of the combat, which in many cases can determine what you roll for initiative because it's what you were doing right before the fight started. So if you were the person hiding off in the bushes as the party marches forward trying to stay out of sight, you would roll stealth for initiative because how well you were hiding determines how well you can get the jump on the bad guys. It's no longer about how well you saw them or heard them coming. You're the one looking for them. You are the hunter. So rolling stealth makes more sense, and whoever got higher, they're the people who see or don't see the other people. It works out really smoothly and really cleanly. And a lot of that comes from just understanding kind of where we're at in the play and making sure that we can use those tools to their best advantage.
It also gives us an opportunity to give you guys tools for, you know, the person in your group who's all like, but I was looking out. What do you mean I didn't get a bonus? And I only, you know, it's a way for you to give them a little bit of a bonus. Go, okay, so you were keeping a lookout. So you were going to get this kind of bonus or whatever because that's what you told me what you were doing.
Yeah, and we also, this is kind of one of the parts of the game that we're doing a lot of places, which is kind of saying, all right, how are you going to focus on something? And exploration mode is one part of that. So imagine you're playing a first edition Pathfinder game, and you say, all right, you're wandering down this hallway. What is everybody doing? And, you know, the fighter says, you know, I'm watching out for danger, see if anything's coming. And the cleric says, you know, I'm organizing my scrolls to get them ready for if we encounter anything. And the wizard is saying, all right, I am trying to detect magic, and I am also researching that spell that somebody gave me, and I'm also looking out for danger, and I am also whittling this idol because I really want to give it to that.
Well,
that
that's for role playing purposes.
Yeah.
And I'm sneaking. I'm sneaking too.
I'm also sneaking. What exploration mode says is
while whittling.
All right, what is the one thing you're really focusing on? Because exploration mode kind of says you're generally going to be making one roll for something as you explore, and everything else is going to kind of use your DC, your passive version. So it kind of says, okay, everybody's going to pick one major focus. And there are some exploration tactics kind of talked about and codified in the book, but we don't really expect players to say, I am using the sneaking tactic, or I am using the follow tracks tactic. We expect them to tell you what you're doing, and then you can interpret whether that's one of the existing tactics, or we also give you plenty of advice for if you need to kind of make up something else that doesn't quite fit that list. But they all kind of follow the same structure, so that it's much easier to kind of get through that part of time with a really kind of clear and concise set of mechanics for it.
Yeah, I had a group that was I was running just last night that were about to get ambushed by a wolf. And I was like, oh, do any of you have nature? because, you know, they were sitting there, one of the characters was looking for tracks and stuff, and I'm like, well, had you made that nature check, which they failed, they could have rolled nature for initiative to see the tracks and realize a wolf was about to attack. Oh, these are really fresh, right? And they're about to be ambushed. There's lots of interesting ways you can kind of use that to make your game a little more reactive to what the players want to do. The one thing you mentioned in there that's really interesting is that whole aspect of, like, everybody doing everything. In first edition, whenever you called for a knowledge check, how many times did everyone at the table roll?
How many times did one person roll, see a two, and then everybody roll?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And worse still, if you're the character who's supposed to be really good at that thing, and you roll a 10, and you're like, oh, well, I got a pretty good score, and somebody else just happens to roll a 20, all of a sudden they're better at this than you are. And a lot of that just comes from the fact that those things, especially knowledge checks, were just open-ended. Everybody made them all the time, right? One of the things that's in the new game is that if you're in the middle of a fight, making a knowledge check is an action. Stopping to think and go, what is that thing? Takes a moment of your time. But it doesn't have to. If you want to be the guy who's like, yeah, I'm the guy who knows everything about dragons, so I have a very high arcana skill, and you can take the skill feat that says, no, you get to make those checks for free. You're the person who goes, oh, hold on, I know about this. But those are the choices you made for your character. It's not everybody in the group just going, we all know about dragons, it's fine. I know you're the expert who spent your whole life doing it, but I rolled a 20, so sit on it. I think those moments were funny, but they ultimately, for the character who wanted to focus on that thing, he felt kind of cheated. And it happens all the time, right?
And we added a different kind of funny moment to replace it, fortunately, which is we have a new system with more things having critical failures and critical successes. So, for example, if you're trying to recall something,
I don't think
critically
we need to
failing,
tell this story.
I think we do need to tell this story.
I don't think we need to tell this story.
If you critically fail, you get some false information. And we also introduce a concept of secret checks, where a lot of things are kind of by default secret, which means the GM's going to roll your check for you.
So really interesting. Moving on.
Yeah. So for example, say Jason's character was exploring a dungeon and found a mysterious liquid in a bowl. And he tried to identify it, and so I asked him what his religion bonus was, and I rolled for him. He rolled a 1. He didn't know this.
No, I didn't.
His character sure didn't know this. And it's a healing potion, and he had taken a lot of damage. So he drank the holy water.
It was delicious and very refreshing.
Absolutely. The most delicious water he'd ever tasted, but not really a lot of healing.
I'm like, why didn't I get healed? And he's like, yeah, it just tasted like water. And I was like, oh, yeah.
And then we needed the holy water later on.
Yeah, no. The worst part was I had written that adventure and just had forgotten that that's what it was.
No metagaming.
Not
for you.
That's right. I don't do
yeah,
that.
You're just a great non-metagamer.
I'm really good at not metagaming and forgetting what I've written. Yeah. Well, what else?
But in a lot of ways, that creates, you know, it's a much more fun narrative. And so anytime, you know, that we had kind of a rules decision to make, it's like, does this make a better narrative that sort of matches what our expectations of the game to be?
Yeah. I think better narratives and driving decisions.
Yes.
Like, right.
Yeah.
Where you have to focus on things, you have to make decisions in the moment of play rather than a lot of decisions kind of being made in character creation, because you kind of know by rote how it's going to play out in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. We wanted more things where the tactics you're choosing during an encounter while you're exploring are going to make a big difference, and you're going to see that more impactfully.
Yeah, Logan mentioned, touched on a little something here just a moment ago that's worth mentioning, is that we've now made success, failure, critical success, and critical failure a kind of core part of the game engine. Now, sometimes these extremes don't matter all that much, right? We didn't want critical fumbles taking over combat in ways that made combat really swinging. One out of every 20 times you throw your sword across the room wouldn't be a very fun play experience. But in most cases, there usually is something interesting going on with critical successes and critical failures. The heart of these systems is really simple. Roll a 20, it's a critical success. Roll a 1, it's a critical failure. But in addition to that, beat the target by 10, and it's a critical success. Fail the target by 10, and it's a critical failure. And the way this kind of plays out in game is usually when you're the active character, there's something good for getting a critical success and not much happens on a critical failure. If you're the defensive side of that, there's something extra bad that happens on a critical failure. I mean, usually something mildly better that happens on a critical success. So the best examples of this are attack rolls. So if you have critical fail and attack roll, it's just a miss. Nothing bad happens. It's just a miss. But in the future, we might make monsters that if you make a critical fumble in front of them, they could take advantage of it with a reaction. This is how all these systems start interplaying with one another.
If we ever make an NPC one-handed fighter, they could have the riposte reaction that totally does that.
Yeah. Whereas on a saving throw, you really don't want a critical fail. Those saving throws, that's where things get really bad for you. So it really opened up some really interesting design space for us because a plus one to a check now means a lot more than just an extra 5% chance to make it. It also means an extra 5% chance to critically make it.
That's one reason if you're comparing like Pathfinder 1 stuff directly to Pathfinder 2 stuff, you might see some of the bonuses are not as big.
Yeah.
There are a lot of reasons for that, but one of them is because criticals matter a lot more.
Yeah, and getting a little closer to that critical success is much better, right? So when you're playing the game and you're fighting a bunch of lower level henchmen, you're going to find that you critically hit them quite a bit. And you mop them up. And to be honest, from a gameplay perspective, we kind of want you to. They're the henchmen. We want the henchmen to die in droves.
Right. And we did it without an explicit minion system. These are still the same guys that you were fighting before. They have the exact same stats as when you fought them a few levels earlier, and they were like a pretty hefty enemy. But because of the way the success systems work, now you can mop these guys up.
Yeah, it's really cool because at first level, that ogre is quite the challenge and is really hard for you to take down. But you jump ahead of him up to fifth level, and now he's a lower level threat, and you crit him and just knock him out of the fight really quickly. And that speaks to your character's advancement in power and skill. But it also allows us to use those monsters a lot more flexibly as we go up. So on the GM side, it also gives you a lot of extra tools to play around with the game.
And like a single boss martial character can still be a pretty big threat.
Yeah.
Because those criticals are going to really hurt.
Yeah, when he starts swinging that plus three longsword at you that's doing 48 and then he crits you, you're really not going to be too happy about that attack roll.
And if he's a fighter, he'll make you flat-footed from the critical as well, so then that'll make it even easier to crit you the next time.
Yeah. I can't wait to beat up on a whole bunch of characters with those sorts of tools.
I've been having a good time with it.
You've been running Temple, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
The monster.
Yeah. But I think the 4 degrees of success, the critical success, the critical failure, the success and the failure, they have a lot of cool ways that they make some of your choices more tactical. But I think that one of the other key things that they do is they make a lot of the spells we had in the game just more interesting to use and play. And by that, I'm talking about like some of the save or lose, or save or suck really bad, so you might as well have lost spells that we had in Pathfinder First Edition. Because in First Edition, you had these spells, and one of two things happened when you cast them. Either the enemy made their save, and you wasted your turn, and everyone in the party's like, what are you doing, wizard? You're not even helping.
More magic missiles.
And that, or you cast it, and you ended the encounter, and it was done, and everyone's like, wizard, you glory hound, you just did everything, we didn't even get to play. And generally, it wasn't real fun for most people at the table, no matter what happened. Although there was that moment of tension to see which of the two not that fun things were going to happen. But with the 4 degrees of success, we can do something that's a lot more interesting. If the enemy critically succeeds on their save, sure, nothing will happen to them. That's always a possibility, but it's not all that likely unless it's a major boss enemy that you're fighting against. If they succeed on the save, something bad still happens to them. It's maybe not that bad, but it's still, you've done something to affect them. You're going to give them some sort of penalty. You've done some damage.
And it's usually bad in a way that other characters can step up and gain some sort of advantage.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And if they fail to save, something pretty darn bad is going to happen to them. They'll take damage that's equal to closer to 2 hits from the fighter's sword than 1, and in a big area or take a big penalty, something that keeps them in the fight, helps your other allies, or in some other way participates alongside everybody else to beating the enemy. Now, if they critically fail, they might be done. It depends on the spell. They're at least in a really bad shape. However, that's also not that likely, but it's always there on the die. So you have all that same tension of maybe it's going to be the really extreme thing, but it's usually not the really extreme thing. It's usually something in the middle that's a little bit more fun to play.
So we've got about 5 minutes left in this seminar, and the next one is going to be mostly Q&A, but for those of you who aren't going to be able to attend that seminar, I'm going to open it up to questions just for about the last 5 minutes here. We're going to keep these light and rapid fire, so if you have something really in-depth, then I suggest you come back for the next one, and we'll just keep it moving. You shut up here right away.
So you mentioned with the reaction during the, I guess, action mode, you called it, or...
Encounter mode, yeah.
Does having a shield still add to your armor class and other things?
So we're going to repeat the question just for Twitch. So the question was, when you have a shield, does a shield still give you a bonus to your armor class? Yes, it does. But there's a little bit of a difference. Using a shield is now a bit more of a tactical choice. So when you got those three actions, you can just take three attacks, but each attack comes with a bigger and bigger penalty. So that last attack, you know, you might not want to take. But if you're wielding a shield, you can use you have to spend an action to get the bonus from it. So you're basically saying, I'm going to devote part of my concentration, part of my turn, to defending myself with the shield, and that gives you the bonus to AC. Once you do that, then you have the ability to take the reaction to throw it in front of an attack and have it absorb some of the damage. It works like damage reduction. It then absorbs some of the hit and you take less damage. Because historically, that's what shields were good for, right? I mean, you threw it in front of the attack, the shield got beat up instead of you. The game never really simulated that very well. It always just was like, yeah, I have a bonus to AC and I don't know, I guess that's enough.
But more bonus to AC.
Yeah, and more bonus to AC. So instead, we wanted it to be a little bit more of an active part of the game. So, yeah, so that's what it does. But it still gives you that bonus to AC, but now you can also use it to absorb hits. Okay. Yeah. Over here. In the gray.
Just a quick one. With the swinginess of the D20, we've all been there where your dice just won't roll above a 5.
Sure.
One night. Do you feel that minus 10, plus 10 is something you might want to look at expanding or contracting, depending on how it is, for that critical save versus critical failure?
Well, expanding it to be a...
Repeat.
Oh, yeah, sorry. The question was, the D20 is very swingy die, so should we expand or possibly contract the 10 threshold for critical success and critical failure? So there's a big advantage of the 10 threshold in a lot of ways that make it so... At the very least, expanding it is not a real good idea. Contracting it, I wouldn't want to do it, but it's something that we would be more able to consider. Here's why. It is a great number because it is exactly the tens place, so you can easily calculate what it is by just, if I need a 15, that means a critical is a 25 and a critical failure is a 5. It's easier math. You don't have to really do addition. You just flip the tens place by 1. So that's one thing. But also, it's exactly half the size of the D20. It has some great effects, such as like when you're right in the middle and you need a 10 or an 11, you still only get critical successes and failure on the 1 and the 20. And then as you go towards the edge, you start getting, if you need a 5 to hit, now you crit on a 15 through 20.
That difference is most pronounced when you're fighting monsters kind of a much higher level or a much lower level, when you really start to see more crits come up on attack rolls against weaker monsters and more crit failures against the spells of higher monsters. And we found in playtesting that is a really kind of satisfying difference. It's just kind of about the right amount of noticeability.
If you had 15, you'd almost never actually have that apply. It would just be the 20s and the 1s. If you had 5, then even on things that are about the same as you, you'd have a huge 1 in 4 chance of crit failing and crit succeeding. So 10 is at least, if not exactly perfect, very close to perfect and easy to use.
In the middle of the swing.
All right, we have a question from Twitch.
Yes, so from Poison Elf, how much are you willing to make changes based on feedback? Is there a chance for major rule changes if there's enough call for it?
Yeah. So if the rest of you didn't get that, the question was, you know, we are about to go into an open playtest. And when you playtest a game, yeah, you're going to make changes. And Our playtest window is, you know, from now until the end of the year. During that period of time, we're going to be running through the Doomsday Dawn adventure, playing through that in 7 parts, and getting a lot of feedback from hopefully all of you about how the game is working. And if there are parts of the game that don't work, that aren't doing what we need them to do, we're going to change them. We want a game that works for as many of our players as possible. We're not going to be able to make everybody happy. I mean, the nature of the game is that there are going to be things that don't work for everybody who plays. But we got to try and make sure that it works for as many people as possible. So if everybody comes and says, you know that resonance system? Meh. There's a lot of people, meh. And we get that. We understand why there is a lot of grr around that system. It's a complex system. It's a system that changes something fundamentally about the game. But we wanted you to give it a try and see how it actually works and see if it is actually doing what we intended it to do. If it is, maybe it'll stick around in some form. If it doesn't, we'll change it and make it something different. That's our job. Our job is to find a way to make this game the game that we all want to play. And I hope you'll join us on that trip.
There's also another thing is if we end up going through this process and we make a game that you guys don't like and don't want to play, which is like all of a sudden we have to go out and get real jobs. So why the hell would we?
And on that, everybody, I think we're at time. I want to thank you guys for coming. I hope you guys have a great Gen Con. If you haven't, go down and pick up one of them books. We still have plenty left.